once again, let's give a big welcome for Chris D, all the way from Santa Barbara.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Gil for asking me to share, and Raina for being a great hostess today. And Brenda, thank you for welcoming us. And Mike, thanks for your talk. And Loretta, thanks for driving up with me. And Travis and Steven, welcome, and I hope you stay. I got sober on July 11th of 1990, so it will be just over 32 years sober. I know I look only like 29 or something, but I was looking at my gray in the bathroom like, oh, God. And if you can envision this, well, first of all, Don L., who's coming from Washington, I watched him get sober. He was a total hot mess. You could tell him I told you so. He's speaking in Orcutt next week. Maybe I'll meet you guys up there and do that again. My husband and I got sober together with Don and his wife, Eileen, and so he's got a great AA talk, if you haven't heard it, like phenomenal. So way better than me, and you can tell him I said that too. Anyway, it's just fun to hear that, you know, people are out there doing the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was sitting here listening to Chapter 5 tonight, and I, you know, when you're in your own home group meetings, you don't always listen as well as you maybe could or should. But when you're in a meeting, especially when you're about to speak, or at least when I'm here, thinking about spending the next 45 minutes with you, telling you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, I was listening to Chapter 5, and I'm like, you know what? That shouldn't work. That should not work. Admit that I have a problem, give it over to God, and none of you can really help me. And that's going to keep me sober for over 32 years. That is baloney. This should not work. In and of itself, when you think about it, it makes no scientific sense, right? Become totally powerless, stop doing something, and then let somebody else run your life for the rest of your life. That's basically what it feels like when you get newly sober, at least it did for me. And it doesn't make sense that it works. You know, and I went to church my whole life growing up, and that was supposed to work. That was supposed to solve all the problems. I wasn't supposed to lie. I wasn't supposed to cheat. I wasn't supposed to steal. I wasn't supposed to be a stalker. I wasn't supposed to be a drunken, yeah, I did all of those things, right? And church didn't fix it for me. And it's funny that we're in a church tonight, you know, but the chairs are really much more comfortable than the church I grew up in. So anyway, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being sober. I'm really grateful for my life today. And I was telling Loretta that, and on the way up here, I think we were just pulling into the parking lot, and I don't remember what the conversation was, but it was basically talking about, like, when did I start feeling comfortable in AA? And I will tell you, it was maybe in the last 10 or 15 years. It was not my first 10 or 15 years. So if you're uncomfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're fitting right in, right? It is okay to feel squirrely, right? It's okay to be pissed off. It's okay to think, God, is this all there is? You know, this is hard work here. And we forget to talk about that because they say, keep it simple, keep coming back, just show up, call your sponsor. But it's bigger than that. You have to change your whole life. It says that in the big book, but you don't really realize it. It's a slow process, but everything has changed for me. I look back at who I was when I was new, and first of all, I had really big permed hair. That's for sure changed. I mean, like really big, like John Bon Jovi, big John. Anyway, so I will tell you a little bit what it was like and how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and how Alcoholics Anonymous works in my life today. I don't do a big long drunk log because I think we all identify with drunk logs. And I remember in my first 5 years of sobriety, I loved, you know, the stories. But I really wanted to hear how the heck were people staying sober when life happens? Because it is freaking hard. And the last 3 to 5 years for a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially going through the pandemic, I don't know, it seems like it's been hard, right? And maybe I'm just getting old and tired and I don't feel like it anymore. But for the most part, I really love Alcoholics Anonymous and I never not want to be here. Right? I never not want to be able to say I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I never want to be here and wonder if something better is going on somewhere else. I never say no to Alcoholics Anonymous. Never. That sounds ridiculous, but that's why I'm still sober, I will tell you. I never say no to AA. Somebody says, can you come to, up the coast to come to a meeting and speak? Yeah, I can. And guess what? I did not feel like being here tonight. I was not in the mood to be here. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to not do it, but I just didn't feel like it, you know? And guess what? I got in the shower at 3:45. I was ready at 4:30 when I said I was going to be ready. I had gas in my car. I had cleaned my car. Loretta was on time. We got to the restaurant at 6 o'clock when we said we were going to be there. We got to this meeting, and here I am. Because that's what you do in Alcoholics Anonymous. That is not who I used to be before I got here. I grew up in a alcoholic home. Both my parents got sober when I was in high school, so when I was young, they were drunk. But it was a happy drunk family. We were, I'm the oldest of three, and I grew up down in La Crescenta area for a little bit, and then down in the South Bay area of Los Angeles. My mother's passed on now, but her name was Mary Catherine Flanagan, if that tells you how Irish I am. She grew up on the south side of Chicago in a very abusive alcoholic home and ran away from home at 23. Nobody runs away at 23, but she did. And got on a train out of Chicago, lived in like a boarding house in Los Angeles, didn't tell her parents she was leaving, and that was the only way she could get out of her home. My dad grew up in an alcoholic home in Long Beach, and he's actually speaking at a conference in St. Louis, Missouri this weekend, so that's where he's at 82 years old and 39 years sober, and just get out of his way, that's all I have to say. But at that time, when he was getting in trouble as a high school student, he tells his story, and he says that he was standing in front of the judge, and they said, well, you can go to juvie or you can go to the seminary. And it was 1950 something, and he went to the seminary and decided to become a priest. And he didn't stay that on that route, obviously, or here, although I say obviously now, but you know, who knows, right? but he went into the seminary, and he said that he left the seminary because he woke up from a blackout on a date and realized he was in the wrong profession. So, you know, and I'm not here to tell his story, but that's his story. And so he met my mom. They met. It's funny that it's Easter weekend because it was Good Friday weekend. Their first date was on the back of my dad's Harley with a six-pack at Malibu after midnight mass or something like that. So, that's who they were, and that's how we were raised, and with kind of funny stories and lots of joy and lots of crazy and lots of alcoholism, and I didn't even notice it. I didn't even see it as a child. My parents worked really, really hard to give us a really good life, what they thought was a good life, and you know, big Christmases, and I mean, it sounds kind of stupid, and I'm sorry if it offends you or makes you feel like I'm, you know, a spoiled brat, because I really was a spoiled brat, but, you know, I remember one Easter coming outside to the backyard, and there were baby bunnies and ducks, baby ducklings running around the backyard, because that's my mom thought would make a nice Easter for us, and yep, I'm not kidding, and so she went overboard all the time, just to maybe make up or maybe to give us what she didn't have, I don't know. But we were loved and we were cherished and adored, and they wanted us. And I remember not wanting to be in my own skin, you know? So what I'm trying to tell you with that is, like, I had these beautiful stories of a childhood that I just couldn't be comfortable. I remember being in second grade, and I would pretend that I would fly over the playground so that I didn't have to talk to people. And I'm a very social person normally, but in that particular instance, I would go out to recess and I would pretend not to be there so that I didn't have to be there, you know? And I don't know what that is. I don't know if that's restless irritable discontent. I don't know if that's social anxiety. I don't know if that's trauma. We talk about a lot of these things now. All I know is that I couldn't sit still in my own skin and I didn't have an answer. So I just kept on going and doing what I needed to do. My younger sister is a member of Al-Anon for quite a few years now. My younger brother has is not a 12-stepper, but they both will tell you that they had a sister who acted and thought that she was an only child until I was about 25. So that's just the way I behaved in my house. I was quite a bit older than both of them and just had no time or interest in them. So I think I was pretty self-absorbed, pretty anxious, and pretty uncomfortable in my skin from the moment I can remember. And I had never had any alcohol early on, right? So I'll just cut to middle school and high school. I think middle school is the worst time of life for everyone. I think nobody should have to go back to middle school. If you think about it, nobody goes to their middle school reunions. Everybody hates them. It's where all of our trauma and crisis happens, and it's the reason why you drink in high school, because you're like, finally, right? But I think middle school is horrible. It was horrible for me. I had a big silver cap on my tooth and this hair out to here, and I was just, this is awful. And I got more and more uncomfortable in my own skin. My parents were drinking quite a bit. We had moved. I was the new kid. And everything didn't seem right. It just seemed wrong. I don't know how else to explain it. It just seemed wrong. I had parents. I was going to a nice school. I lived in a nice neighborhood. But the parents were drunk. I was uncomfortable and didn't fit in. And it was slowly and surely becoming a show that I couldn't participate in. And, you know, I wish I had picked up a drink earlier some days. And other days, I don't even know if I'd be here if I'd done that, you know, because I know that I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and there was a lot of drugs and alcohol everywhere. It wasn't, nobody was vaping, none of the early stuff that kids are doing now. But I remember little packets of cocaine being passed around in eighth grade. It was just there, you know. I wasn't doing it because I was also this kid who was like, well, I can't do that. My mom's drunk, so I can't do that. And I am the kid who poured the alcohol down the sink, you know, with the alcoholic parent. So I have both sides of the coin here, right? When I got to high school, it increasingly got more uncomfortable. And I know that I picked up my first drink unintentionally, but I knew that I was looking for relief. At that point, I was stealing, I was lying, I was cheating, I was crashing the car that I was able to drive. And it wasn't my car, so that's why I say it that way. And at some point in 1983, I picked up my first drink, and I never intended to do that because my mom was a drunk. My dad was never home now because he was also a drunk. And it was very toxic in our household. And I'm a parent of two teenagers now, so I know the difference of what it looks like to have a sober home and not, with my husband and I both being sober. But and my kids have never seen me drink. So when that happened, my cousin was living with us, and her parents had both died of alcoholism, or on their way to dying of alcoholism at that point. And I said, I just think you need to take me out to learn how to drink so I don't do what they do. Like, that was my story, right? And I'm not kidding you, and it's totally foofy, but it's my literally the first drinks I ordered. Two double Long Island iced teas and a Mai Tai chaser. Now, I had never drank before, and that's what I ordered that night. Yeah. And you know what? I didn't throw up, and I didn't black out. Game on. Seriously, game on. I could handle my alcohol, and that was a bad thing for someone like me. Because I get behind the wheel when I drink, and I call people I shouldn't call when I drink, and I go by people's homes and shouldn't be there, and my behavior was bad from the first drink, and I swear to you, 2 weeks before, maybe even a week before, maybe even 3 days before, I was pouring out my mother's alcohol, saying I was never going to be like her. 3 weeks later, I'm drinking, like I just told you, first time out the gate, always with a bottle, never a glass, right? If I wasn't gonna get drunk, I wasn't gonna drink. Who does that? We do, right? We do. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that's what alcoholism was. I thought alcoholism was you're drunk on a bench and you don't have a home, right? You live down on Skid Row. You had a bad family. You never went to church. You were not a good person. Whatever those things were, I thought that was alcoholism, right? What the weird thing that happened, though, that was like in the fall of 83, my mom checked herself into rehab in February of 84. So I was like, ugh, right there. And what happened in 1984, for those of you who are younger than me and don't know about the 80s and the rehab stints that were going on, everybody was going to rehab in AA, and everybody was on TV talking about sobriety, and you know, it was like, it was a thing. And we lived down in like the San Pedro area of Los Angeles. If you know that area, it's like the port of Los Angeles. And there were movie stars at the rehab, like rock stars and movie stars that were in our rehab with my mom and dad and all of us. And we had to go 3 nights a week, 6 hours a week or 8 hours a week. It was a lot. And it was like, it was a family thing. We're all getting sober together. My mom got sober in the hospital. My dad got sober 3 weeks later. And they're sitting there telling us, if you have one alcoholic parent, then you have 50% chance of becoming an alcoholic yourself. And if you have two alcoholic parents, you might as well stop, you're doomed. And I'm like, I had just started. You know, I had just started drinking. I'm like, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous. I am not them. And that did not stop me. You know, it did put a little pause, but it did not stop me from drinking. And in fact, it gave me permission. Fine, good. Now you guys are done. It's my turn, right? And that's kind of what happened. And, you know, I picked different friends. I didn't do well in school. I crashed cars. And I eventually basically didn't go out and drink because I was too afraid that I wouldn't get home, you know. And I ended up kind of graduating from high school. I don't know how I got into college, but I did. And I went to college. But before that, I was graduating from high school and I was drinking all the time. And I was, I think I was probably depressed too. If I know what we do now with kids and I look back then, I'm sure I had all kinds of anxiety and depression and blah, 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 all that stuff. But I was drinking and getting drunk is what I was doing. And I was making a complete ass out of myself on a regular basis to where the point I lost the keys to my dad was newly sober, got a new company car, and I lost the keys and the car. And somebody had to drive me home and we had to go back and find the car, but we didn't have the keys. And those are the kinds of things that I did. You know, it sounds kind of light touch. I never went to jail. You know, and I should have for a lot of different things, whether it had been stealing, drinking and driving, whatever. I just never made it there. But I did make it to rehab in July of 1985. And at that rehab, they took me off of alcohol, sugar, and caffeine. Who does that? That's just stupid. But that's what they were doing. And I pretty much dried out, got a lot of therapy. Stayed home and then realized that the best answer was to get out of my house. And I had two newcomers for parents. And when you have newcomers that are Irish Catholics, they're really guilty. So I absolutely knew how to manipulate them and pretty much get whatever I wanted going off to college. And I don't say that because it's like, I don't know why I say it. I think it's because I didn't know that's what I was doing. And I know now that's what I was doing. I was angry. God, I was angry. And I was so spoiled. I mean, so spoiled. And I was just, you don't understand my life, and you don't understand who my parents are, and oh, such a baby. God, we are so immature in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those of us who come in here, we are the biggest babies ever. And I think it's when we start drinking, we kind of get stuck there, you know, whether it's 13, 14, 15, 16, whatever that age is. And I just was really immature. I did go to college, switched my majors around a couple times. By the time I was graduating, the dean of my department called me in and said, you have all C's and D's. Now we can pass you, but you can never really go on to graduate school or study this. And I literally said, that's okay, I'm gonna be a movie star. I don't need this degree anyway. I'm not kidding you. I stole my mom's credit card, bought a $400 pair of sunglasses, did my graduation thing, turned the sunglasses back in, and went on my merry way. And I thought I was so cool. Now, it was another thing I was sharing with Loretta. It's like, okay, so you have a college degree, you have parents, you have people helping you financially, which I did. Not everybody has that. I had a car, I had an apartment. None of it I was paying for. Not self-supporting through my own contributions at all. And I had just graduated from college. It was 1990, and my dad, my sister was in college and my brother was about to go to college. And he was 6 years sober and turning 50 years old that year. And he said, he called me up and he goes, great, you got your degree, what are you gonna do? And I said, oh, I'm gonna get a job at some point. He goes, well, guess what? It's July 1st is my 50th birthday and you're financially cut off. So figure it out. There's no coincidence that July 11th I got sober. It was like 11 days later. what happened was is that I went to a meeting with him. I think he knew I was a dry drunk. I wasn't drinking at that point. I had dropped a sewing machine on my foot, and I was casually using codeine and Tylenol. And I wasn't drinking because somebody said you shouldn't mix those. I now know that that probably would have actually been a lovely mix. But I didn't mix those, and that was fine. But he said, why don't you come with me to hear this guy Clancy speak? He's a big speaker down in L.A., and this was in 1990. And I'm like, it was 4th of July weekend, so just past July 1st, not quite July 11th yet. And I did not know who he was. I thought he was mean and loud and angry. And sometimes he was. And I will tell you a little bit more about him later. But he talked about alcoholism. Not drinking. He talked about alcoholism. And he talked about the phenomenon of craving and the mental obsession and all of the things that happen when those things are in play. But the most important thing he said that night, and again, I was 23. I did not have a job. I was in a lot of fear. I know I was. And I wasn't drinking, but I wasn't sober. So remember how that feels in that moment of like, it's awful. It's the worst feeling ever. I'd rather be drunk or I'd rather be sober, but that in between is just painful, right? And he said, alcoholics don't have a drinking problem. That is not their problem. They have a living problem. And that living problem becomes so painful that the only answer they have is to drink. And when they drink, they get drunk. And when they get drunk, their life gets worse. And I'm paraphrasing that, but that's what I heard that night. I was like, damn it, I'm an alcoholic. I have a living problem. I'm not the drunk on the couch that abused her children, my mom. I'm not the drunk that's taking me to the meeting who, you know, everything looks good on the outside and everything's falling apart on the inside kind of thing. I'm not the people in rehab because I have a drug addiction. I'm an alcoholic. I have a living problem. I cannot figure out how to do this without something else getting, you know, without something else distracting me. And that was really like painful and like a deep breath at the same time, right? And so I don't really know why I ended up at this next meeting, but I did go to the Pacific Group meeting that following week. That was Clancy's home group. That's the group he started. I didn't put those dots together. I didn't know that. I went there because I went to an all-women's Catholic college in Los Angeles, and the girls there said, who had gone to that meeting as a kind of sample 12-step meeting, said there were cute boys and movie stars there. So I was a stalker, and I'm going. So that's the only reason why I went to that meeting that night. And at least I think it is. Who knows, right? But a woman got up and shared, did a 10-minute talk, and she talked about the chaos of her life before she ever picked up her first drink. And it talked about all the things that happened. Then finally she started drinking and she felt better, but her life got worse. I was like, oh, right. I forgot. That's me. And I don't know why, but I did walk up to her at that break. And I said, I don't think I'm an alcoholic, but I really identified with your story. My parents are in AA. And I don't think she knew what to do with me. I don't know if she thought I was an Alateen, an Al-Anon, whatever it was at that point. I wasn't saying I was an alcoholic. And she said, well, you can call me. She goes, and it's, so she, I got her number. And I called my dad the next day and I said, hey, I met this woman at this, you know, Pacific Group meeting, and I'm going to call her and maybe go to an AA meeting tomorrow. But tonight I'm going to happy hour. And I laughed because it sounds really funny to me now. But I was really serious because I thought, oh, if I'm going to go to AA tomorrow, I should drink today. Right? I mean, that makes sense to the alcoholic. And he saved my life that night. And he said, you know, why don't you not drink tonight? Go get some appetizers, go out with your roommates, whatever, but don't drink because you may not end up at the meeting tomorrow. It may not be a priority. So wait, go to the meeting. What he was trying to say is if you get drunk tonight, there's no way in hell you're going to that meeting tomorrow night because it would have been game on again. And I heard him. I don't know why, but I heard him that night and I didn't drink. I did go out, but I didn't drink. And the next night I picked up this woman. Her name was Pasha. She was from Boston and asked me to pick her up to go to this women's meeting on Friday night. And it was the Pacific Group women's meeting. So there were over 100 women there, many with over 10, 15, 20 years of sobriety. And we ran around the room. And well, I got in the car. And this is important if you're new. I got in the car and she said, well, when was your last drink? And I actually couldn't remember. I said I had the codeine and the Tylenol and this and that. And it could have been 6 weeks. It could have been 3 weeks. I couldn't remember at that point. It was July 10th or July 11th at that time. And she goes, well, have you been going to AA? I said, no, I don't go to AA. I'm not an alcoholic. And she goes, well, why are we going to this? I said, I don't know. And we're just going. And she goes, okay, so what's wrong with you? I said, I don't know, but I'm always uncomfortable. She goes, okay, so you don't know when your last drink is, so you're going to raise your hand. I met you on Wednesday, and it's Friday. You're going to raise your hand with 2 days of sobriety because you have to qualify to go to this meeting. And I'm like, okay. And in my mind, I'm like, one more time, I'm lying. I'm telling myself I'm lying about being an alcoholic. But I didn't know. I didn't really understand what alcoholism was yet. And the thing is about that meeting is that when you go to those meetings, when I got sober, you raise your hand, and if you're a newcomer, if you have if you have 1 week or less of sobriety, you raise your hand at the beginning of the meeting. And at the end of the meeting, you raise it if you're under 30 days. If I had walked in with 42 days of sobriety, I would have missed that immediate meeting of like me being the newcomer and you welcoming me. I wouldn't have known what that felt like. She knew what to tell me. She knew that I wasn't sober, that I may not have been drinking, but I was crazy and I was close to a drink because I had no sobriety under my belt. And I should raise my hand with 2 days of sobriety. That is my sobriety day today, right? And all before cell phones. So I walked away with little pieces of paper, like stacks of papers with people's phone numbers on them. And then she said, come back to the meeting the next night. And by Sunday, I had a sponsor, and I was going to 7 meetings a week, and I had 7 commitments, and I was to call her at 7 o'clock in the morning. And then she said the magic words, and no back talk. And I was like, what is she talking about? And I cannot tell you how many times that woman hung up on me in my first year of sobriety. Because like I said, I was a spoiled brat. In my first 30 days of sobriety, I did share with you a couple times now that I said I was a stalker. I'm not kidding. I was a stalker. Because it was much easier to have a relationship with you in my head than it was to have it like together with us talking to each other. So I would like drive by this guy's house and... in fact, Raina, he went to South High, but that's another story. Raina and I found out we grew up in the same kind of neck of the woods. But and I couldn't stop myself, and I knew I shouldn't be doing it. It felt like the bad thing, like I was doing something bad. And I would sit outside, because I used to sit outside. This is dating me too, but I used to sit outside of his house with Bartles and James wine coolers and just drink in my car. This is before I got sober. Now I was just driving by his house because I was on my way home to my parents' house. And it's so like embarrassing and stupid, but that's what I was doing. And so finally I called my sponsor, and it was my first kind of like telling on myself kind of thing. And I said, so there's this guy and he doesn't want to know me or date me, but I keep driving by his house and parking and I can't stop. And she goes, well, I'm going to tell you what to do. And, okay, you ready? Knock that shit off. And I swear to God, it was my first AA miracle because I never did it again. I'm not kidding you. And, you know, so it was just kind of like, oh, wow. And it was like, I can change my behavior and it changes the way I feel. I'm going to say that again. I can change my behavior. I can change and it changes the way I feel and the way I think, right? And it's exactly opposite of what we think. Oh, if I think about this long enough, then my feelings will change and then my actions will change. It doesn't work that way. I have a 19-year-old turning 20 who's got, he's a giant ball of ADHD and he's an amazing kid. I'm like, Jack, just stop thinking and take the right actions. And he literally looks at me and goes, what does that even mean? And he's never had a drink, and sometimes I wish he would because I think he'd fit in so well here, but anyway, we'll see. I'm just praying for him on a regular basis. And I have to, you know what? I just realized I totally just lied to you. I'm not a stalker, but I'm so obsessed with looking at him on Find My Phone. That's totally stalking. I just busted myself with my 19-year-old son. Anyway, so it just, I got sober in that first year, and I'm going to really watch my time here because I'm kind of stuck in where it was. But in my home group, we had to finish our fourth step before we turned a year sober. They wouldn't let you take an AA cake. It was just the way it was. It was a little bit hardcore, but I didn't mind it because I did it. It got done. And I was into my ninth step by my 11th month of sobriety. So if you're struggling with the steps, just jump in a little bit. Just jump in a little bit because it really changes your life. You don't have to do it perfect, and I will trust me, you'll do them again. It won't be the last time. Something will come up. Anyway, I got through that first year of sobriety, and now the work began. I had a year of sobriety. I had an apartment. I had a job. You know, I really loved Alcoholics Anonymous. My husband is also sober in AA, but he argues with me on this point. But I, in the Pacific Group, when we were getting sober, he got sober in 1987. And I think between like 1987 when he got sober and he was 21 when he got sober and when I got sober into 1992, in that 5 to 6 years of time, there must have been at least 300 to 400 people between the ages of 18 and 25 getting sober. I mean, Don Landis, the guy you'll hear next week, was one of them. But a lot of us have now 25, 30, 35, 40 years of sobriety. We're all still here, a lot of us, because of what we learned in those early years. Commitments, service, showing up. My sponsor ended up moving back to the East Coast, and I got her sponsor as my sponsor. And we just went on our journey together. We kept doing the work. And I'll tell you, you know, if I wrap it up in a nutshell, you know, I started having panic attacks at a year and a half of sobriety, and I figured out that I had had some pretty severe childhood trauma that was kind of popping itself back up. And I dealt with that outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went back through the steps and dealt with it inside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I allowed God to heal me in a way that I don't know that I even knew needed being healed. And I still deal with it on a regular basis. Some things will pop up. And, you know, I have a 16, almost 17-year-old daughter and, as I said, a 19-year-old son. And I said to my daughter the other day, I said, God, I think I have a lot of anxiety. And she literally like slammed something down. She goes, what are you talking about? You've had anxiety as long as I've known you. She's 16. I'm like, Jesus. Okay, thank you, Dr. Freud. But anyway, so it's just kind of funny what they know, right? But I did want to be a star in alcohol, not in Alcoholics Anonymous, but kind of an AA, because in the Pacific Group, we did these like New Year's Eve shows and these musicals, and it was kind of silly. And I saw my first AA musical in Bakersfield in 1990, I don't know, October of 1990, when I was just getting sober. And I cried through the whole thing, and my sponsor's like, what's wrong with you? I'm like, I'm so happy I can do musical theater in AA. I mean, it was so dumb. But it was like, it really like I saw a light in Alcoholics Anonymous that I had not been able to be comfortable in my whole life anywhere else. I ended up becoming a teacher, and I taught musical theater for 15 years of my career. I went off to theater school in New York at 2.5 years of sobriety, and I did want to be a star, I thought, but it's way too self-obsession for me. But I loved the whole art of it. But I went off to New York at 2.5 years of sobriety. I had a very tumultuous relationship with my mom. We were both sober, but we had a tough relationship. We came from a lot of dysfunctional alcoholism. I know today, and I'd say this, and she would laugh if she was sitting here and kind of be embarrassed, but my mom loved me, but I don't think she ever really liked me. I was really annoying to her. And I joke around, and I promised her I would never tell the story when she was alive, and now she's gone 5 years. But she met my dad and got pregnant, and then had me, and then had a big resentment, and then had my brother and sister, and she liked them way better. And it doesn't mean that I was a bad person. We just had, that's how we started our relationship, on resentment and fear, right? And it just stayed there with us until I was about 40 and my daughter was just born. And I was 17 years sober at 40 years old. We were having this conversation, and all of a sudden she goes like this, and she puts her hand up to me, and she puts her hand in my face. This conversation is over. Like, I just started laughing and go, Mom, who do you talk to in AA like that? I know you don't talk to your sponsor that way, and I'm certain you don't talk to your sponsees that way, so can we do this differently? And she just broke down into tears. She goes, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't see you, and now I see you. 17 years of sobriety, 23 years of sobriety on her end, right? And that was when we started healing. Not at 6 months of sobriety, not at 5 years of sobriety, although it was all happening. I was getting sponsor direction, she was getting sponsor direction, and, you know, oof. She died on March 27th, 5 years ago, and that's my wedding anniversary. And the day before, I had seen her for dinner because I'd flown out for my sponsor's 45th AA birthday that I had planned, the big party for her. And she was supposed to come with me, but couldn't come because she was sick. And so I went up to have dinner with her, and I'm skipping around a little bit because I want to get to the end and talk about like real sobriety stuff. But she was in a wheelchair sitting at the table with me and my sister and my dad, and she was getting better. And we thought she was on her way to mending. And we were sitting at the dinner, and you know, here I am now, I'm at 27 years of sobriety. I've got two kids. I'm married a long time. I'm moving back to California. I just spent my time with my sponsor. Like, things were good. She was excited I was coming home. I was excited I was coming home. And we sat at that dinner that night, you know, all sober and members of Al-Anon and AA, laughing and cracking up about like dumb stuff and just having good sober family time. And if you haven't had good sober family time, you will have it, but you have to bring it. It's not going to be given to you. You have to bring the good sober family time. And you may not have a family that you can bring it to, but you do here. And I don't ever want to talk up here and say, oh, but you'll have a great time with your family. Sometimes you won't, and I understand that. In my particular case, we were all sober. We were sitting at that dinner that night. And she started to lament about the shoulda, coulda, wouldas in Alcoholics Anonymous. And gosh, if I had only done this, and maybe if this had happened. And I, you know, she was an alcoholic parent with a lot of shame. And I'm not. I have a lot of stuff that I wish I hadn't done in sobriety or in my parenting, because we all have stuff. But I didn't have that. I didn't have drunk, I hate you conversations, not showing up, all the stuff that came with our story of alcoholism. But at this point, I'm like 51. I don't remember how old I was. I know I was over 50. I'm 27 years sober. I've got two kids. I've got a job. I've got a master's degree. I mean, like, my life is good. I've worked hard in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not looking for anyone to take responsibility for anything that might not be going right in my life. I'm owning all of my stuff. And she looks at me and she's just like, yeah, but if I didn't, I go, Mom, can you please stop? Just stop. You don't have to carry that baggage anymore. You've been sober for 3/4 of my life. It's over. Any problems I have today are of my own making. You can be free. You're okay. And she died the next day. You know? And I know that, and my sister and I both believe that she heard the freedom that we get here, that she was free. And my uncle, who's also in AA, her brother, yeah, we're getting a little sick a lot here, said to me at her funeral, and by the way, I came home to California, I mean, I turned right back around and came home for the funeral. There were 700 people at the funeral, 500 of which were members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. So that tells you who they are and who we are in this family and of what we did in our lives here together. But he said at the funeral that she told him 6 weeks earlier that she felt like her body was getting too heavy for her spirit, you know? And it's like so interesting when you think about what Alcoholics Anonymous does for us, right? It lifts the burden of all of the things that we carry, and it brings us back to the fellowship of the spirit, which is what we're doing here tonight, right? I can tell you that I've had money problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to divorce my husband at 10 years of marriage because he wasn't doing it right. And he likes to say that the horns in my head fit the holes in his, but I'll let him tell his own AA talk. And he says that's a borrowed line from some other old timer, but he can have it now. I think Norm Albee might have said it. But my sponsor at the time said, when are you going to figure out that he is neither your problem nor your solution? When are you going to figure that out? You know, and at that point, I had a 4- and a 6-year-old. I went back to graduate school. I was working full time. And he's never been my problem nor my solution since. And we have this beautiful life together. We just celebrated 24 years of marriage together and 30 years together. And it's a little breakup in between. But we have a really good life today. We love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had postpartum depression really badly after my son was born. And there were no amount of meetings that could fix that. And everybody said, oh, go to more meetings, get out, you can do it. Nope, it was all hormones, it was all awful. If you're a woman and you've gone through childbirth and you've had, or you're going through new babies at home and you've had depression, get outside help. AA really works when you have the right tools in place. You know, I didn't have postpartum depression with my second child, right? We moved, and I'll wrap it up with this, at 20, right when I was talking about when I was moving back here to California, I had a situation where I was living in Kansas City, Missouri. I've lived in New York and gone to AA there. I told you about that. We moved to Dallas when I was 17 years sober. Then we moved to Kansas City when I was 22 years sober. And we moved back to California when I was 27 years sober. So we've done AA everywhere. And guess what? It works everywhere. You jump in, you do it. No, they do it. They always do it differently. And I had someone at my original home group say, you know, I came back for something at some event. And he goes, oh, thank you for gracing us with your presence now that you're back. And I'm like, you know, that's not necessary. But what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is that you take what you learn and you take it somewhere else, and they really need you there. When John and I moved to Dallas in 2006 and I had 17 years of sobriety and he had 20, we had most of the time in our room. There wasn't people that had as much time as us. Now, there are out there, I'm not saying that, but it changes your view of Alcoholics Anonymous when you're the one who people are asking for help for. You are more accountable. You are checking yourself more regularly, at least I was. And I was figuring out that the way I felt comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous was once again, just what I did when I was new, jumping back in and being of service. I started meetings with childcare. I started sponsoring more women. I did a lot of that kind of stuff. And then I did the same thing when I moved to Kansas City. And I moved a lot for work. And so, but what happened in Kansas City is I was 27 years sober and burning out. I was not prioritizing the spiritual principles of this program. I was sponsoring a lot of people and going to meetings, but I was in the wrong job. And sometimes that's really hard because I'm a hard worker. I like to work. I enjoy my work. I enjoy being around people, but it was killing me. And I was feeling like a failure. And I thought, if I just work hard enough, if I just go to more meetings, if I just do another inventory, and that wasn't the answer. I had to quit my job. And I didn't have another job. And my sponsor said, it's time. This job is going to kill you. You're going to lose your sobriety if you don't knock this off. And I did. And it was fine. And then people got mad. And then I had to protect my family. And I went through a really dark time in sobriety because not everyone saw the good intentions. And I thought that if you work hard in Alcoholics Anonymous, you do everything right, that all the right things happen. But sometimes divorces happen, and sometimes you lose your job, and sometimes people treat you poorly, and sometimes really bad stuff happens, and sometimes you have to hire lawyers when you don't think you have to, and I had to do all of that stuff. And my dad, who at the time, you know, was dealing with my mom at home who was sick and then later died, and then, you know, I came home from the funeral and he said, I know that this has been a really hard year on you. He goes, but you are no longer just coming home for you. You're coming home for me. It's like, that's the gift of AA. I couldn't see what I couldn't see until I could see it, right? And I have these two women that have 5.5 years of, that have 5 years of sobriety. No, they're on 5.5 years of sobriety. I met them when I lived in Kansas City. I threw myself into service in Kansas City before I moved back to Santa Barbara, because that's what I knew to do. I went back to the basics again. Meetings every day, calling my sponsor every day, working with newcomers every day. And I couldn't see what I couldn't see. And I got back here and I realized not only was I supposed to be home for my family, but I was supposed to be home for this new community of people that I work with in Santa Barbara that I adore, and they adore me, and it's really easy and it's not hard, and I'm not stressed out and I'm not uncomfortable. I'm at peace with myself, and it's only channeling Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not making me decide I can only do this or this, right? And so I only share that with you. You might have something going on in your life where you're like, God, is this supposed to be how this is? This sucks. I've done an inventory. I'm calling my sponsor. I've made right amends with my family, and I'm really uncomfortable. And I spent 3 or 4 years in sobriety, almost 5, really uncomfortable, questioning God, questioning my spirituality, and I stayed. And I'm, you know, going to be 33 years sober, and in the last 6 to 8 months, I've had a really interesting new spiritual journey. And what I want to say about that is that I just stayed open, and I didn't drink. And, you know, I've said a lot of different things tonight. I was kind of all over the place, but the bottom line, there are two things that kept me sober. I kept showing up, and I always told myself, I'm uncomfortable. I'm angry. I have a resentment. I'm scared. I can't sleep. I'm going to kill my children. I'm going to kill my husband. you know, I'm going to kill you. But I, who cares? I'm telling you, you know, I'm telling on you. And you know what? I'm going to walk free tonight. I'm going to drive home with Loretta. We're going to chat it up all the way home. I'm going to get home and get to bed, hopefully by 11:30. And then I'm getting up at 4 to take my daughter to the airport in the morning because she's got to go on a conference thing for her school stuff. And then I'm going to do tomorrow, right? And I have an 8 a.m. sponsorship meeting, don't we, on Zoom tomorrow morning. So, you know what? It's really good. Like, I knew, like I told you just a few minutes ago that I didn't really feel like doing this. But the benefit is that I showed up for you, and I feel so safe and peaceful in my heart and in my soul right now. And I don't feel like drinking. I don't feel like drinking, and I haven't felt like drinking in a really long time. So if you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're struggling and you're not new, you're my favorite. Because it's painful to stay and not drink and suffer through it and ask for help and tell on yourself. That's what sobriety is. That's what not drinking and working the steps is. That's what showing up is, right? And it's hard because most of us don't stay. The statistics are the same. Most of us don't stay. So I welcome you. I thank you for asking me to be here. I really appreciate it. The opportunity, and I hope that you all have a wonderful rest of the year. Thanks.
Let's give Chris another big round of applause.